Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the October 14, 2018 session focusing on Psalm 90, Holy Terror. I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Crystal Shepherd.
And I'm Bert Montgomery.
Well, welcome back, Crystal.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Crystal was with us on the last episode, so you should be familiar with her. But if not, she's a pastoral counselor at Tree of Life Counseling in Lexington, Kentucky. And we always enjoy having you with us, Crystal.
Thank you.
Daniel's away, but I believe he'll be able to be back with us next time. So before we jump into this text, I just wanted to say a word about Faith Element. I think sometimes we take it for granted that people understand what Faith Element is if you listen to the podcast. But, you know, you might just listen to the podcast and not really consider what Faith Element offers. It's actually a curriculum. And I just want to talk about one of the key ideas that's underneath the curriculum. Yes, it's all online, all that's great. But one of the ideas, and I think we try to model it here on the podcast, is this idea of baggage. And no, I don't mean we're going on a trip. That would be fun. But but I guess what I mean is that we all come to this podcast with baggage. We have experiences and stories and insights from our lives that we bring and we talk about in the lens through the lens of faith. And I think what one of the ideas underneath Faith Element and the way the session pages are built and the whole process is arranged is with the idea that everybody that comes into a Bible study group also brings baggage. They bring good baggage, good stories, good experiences, sometimes not so good experiences. And those are all wonderful fodder for conversations of faith, because that really is where faith makes a difference, is in our real lives. So if you haven't given Faith Element a try as a Bible study curriculum, yeah, it's different, but you can do it. In many ways, I guess what we hope you're going to end up doing is using the prompts that are part of the sessions to have your own kind of podcast with the people you're with. And we hope your conversations are as exciting as ours. We often say we would do this even if no one listened. So,
yeah. It's true.
Okay, well, Bert, I think you might have the intro for us for this one. Can you get us started?
Well, thanks for giving me such an easy one. So much of this passage of Psalm 90 reminds me of Monty Python. Not the Holy Grail or even the Flying Circus, both of which pretty much everybody likes, nor the Life of Brian, which mostly religious nerds like me absolutely adore, and we try to sneak in offensive quotes in our sermons, but from the more haphazard movie, The Meaning of Life. Now, Monty Python loves lampooning our human tendency to imagine God as a grumpy old man in the sky, but they also do so much with religion that tends to offend a lot of people, but if you step back and pay attention, they're not so much making fun of God as much as our understanding of God and how we present God to one another. And in The Meaning of Life, they really hit this tendency of ours to obsess over how small we are and how enormous God is, as well as how angry God always is. There's this one scene in which Michael Palin is a priest, and he invites the congregation of students at a religious high school to join him in prayer, and they share this liturgical prayer back and forth. Let us praise God. O Lord, ooh, you are so big, so absolutely huge. Gosh, we're all really impressed down here, I can tell you. Forgive us, O Lord, for this dreadful toadying and barefaced flattery, but you are just so strong and, well, so super. Fantastic. Amen. And then they all join together and start singing. O Lord, and I can't sing. O Lord, please don't burn us. Don't grill us or toast your flock. Don't put us on the barbecue or simmer us in stock. Don't braise or bake or boil us or stir fry us in a wok. Oh, please don't lightly poach us or baste us with hot fat. Don't fricassee or roast us or boil us in a vat. And please don't stick thy servants, Lord, in a rotissimat. So just, it's a great song and sung with great reverence, right?
Yes.
Psalm 90 is written as a psalm in the spirit of Moses, a prayer of Moses. Now, if how we perceive God, if how we relate to God, if these things are in some way a projection of our own experiences, maybe our own personalities, then that makes a lot of sense that this is related to Moses, because it's no secret that Moses could get angry. He got angry with the Egyptians. These were among the people among whom he was raised. He got angry with the Hebrews, the people that God made him lead out of slavery, and then he was stuck with them in the wilderness. And he got fighting mad with God. And all that's pretty much okay, because the Egyptians, the Hebrews, and all God all got mad at Moses too. So there's a lot of anger in here, and there's a lot about God's wrath for sure. I found a very compelling article by Barbara Brown Taylor about all these types of passages in our Bible, these verses in our scriptures, these basically terrorizing images of God. I'll add a link to the show notes so you can look it up and read about it. But Barbara Brown Taylor writes, "In practice, we tend to preach the terrors by making them less terrible. But what is lost is the very real terror of obeying God without the least idea of how things will turn out in the end, which is, after all, the human situation." And I'm guilty of that. I try to ease over the harshness in our scriptures and emphasize more of the goodness and the love. But I like this phrase that she says, or maybe I'm troubled by this phrase, "What is lost is the very real terror of obeying God without the least idea how things will turn out in the end, which is, after all, the human situation." And that reminds me of the great Queen and David Bowie line, "It's the terror of knowing what this world is about and watching a good friend scream, 'Let me out.'" Reading this psalm is a microcosm of our experience of God, of our experience with God. We realize our insignificance, and we stand in awe. We freeze in awesome fear of the presence of the Creator of the entire universe, and we rejoice, and we are glad in God's favor and steadfast love. Make no mistake, God's love is also throughout this passage, and at least here, it has the last word. I don't have much insight to share here, except to add my own struggle with accepting the love and the terror of God that is in our scriptures. But then again, that's because, as the psalmist says, I'm just but a sigh in this big picture of God's eternity. So I'm looking forward to hearing what y'all have to say about it.
As you were talking, Bert, it occurred to me that growing up, I didn't hear in church a lot about the vastness of God and the timelessness of God. I heard a lot about the awesomeness of God. I mean, I did come along in youth group in the 90s. Our God is an mm-hmm. awesome God was at mm-hmm. its peak. But I think there's a difference to talk about how awesome God is, but then kind of thinking about how timeless God is compared to us. And I think there's an important spiritual discipline in that was not a part of my own faith tradition growing up.
Yeah, that's interesting, Nikki, because I grew up a little earlier than you did. But yeah, I mean, I grew up a lot hearing a kinder, gentler wrath of God than some of my friends heard, but it was still very much there, and we were to be afraid of him, and God was going to get you for that. And God was awesome, and God was big, and God was powerful, but that sense of God being so timeless and enormous, I've grown into that. And part of my growing into that has been that God being so big and timeless means that my doctrine and my beliefs can't grasp them and can't hold them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of what has kept some people living in terror of that maybe God will be bigger than what they hold most dear.
I'm thinking about growing up in the church and the views that we had of God, or the views of God that were instilled in us. And I'm kind of like you, Bert. I got a lot of the wrath of God, maybe not quite. Well, I did visit a church with my friend one time, and Bibles were being thrown and things like that. And I was just like, okay. Yeah. And I was like, I understand the wrath of God now. But I keep thinking of that song that we even sing it in youth group. My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing that my God cannot do. I won't sing it for you. But, you know, as you were talking, I just kept thinking of that. And when you think about that, there's nothing. Yeah, I'm getting the hand signals there. When you think about that, I don't understand how, like, as a child, I didn't think about it. But, like, when I think about it as an adult, how overwhelming is that? There's nothing that God cannot do. So there is really some terror in that, because you don't know what God's going to do. There's, you know, all the time there are unexpected things that come from God. There are blessings and things that come that you didn't anticipate, or something changes in life and you think, wow, I didn't see my life going that direction, but it is. But in the long run, you can look back and say, wow, look what God did. But it's terrifying in the moment. So I don't know if that's making a lot of sense, but it's just, I just think of that song and like how scary that is. How is the Spirit going to move, and what's going to happen?
There's a humility that has to come in order to really be able to engage this. So sometimes it helps me. I'm an anecdote person, and I love to think of stories or examples of things that actually happen that can help us see. As we're talking, I'm thinking about like when I was a teenager, having conversations with people who were much, much older than me, who had lived a lot more life than I had lived. And I remember kind of coming to this realization that maybe if I was talking to someone who went through the Great Depression, that there's no way that I could understand what that person knew and saw. And so there's this kind of awareness that my view of the world and of history is tiny, and that God has this view of history that is so much wider than what mine is, and that I need to kind of sit down, be quiet, pay attention, and live into the humility of that.
I think we get a taste of this kind of overwhelmingness of something that's so much greater and larger than us whenever we are in certain settings in nature. I mean, I remember just a taste of it as a teenager lying in the grass. Yes, this was before fire ants in the South. But yes, lying in the grass, looking up at the stars and just being kind of overwhelmed by it all. Mm-hmm. Or the first time I was in the Rocky Mountains and I got to go up past Estes Park into the National Park, one of those peaks, and you have this incredible overlook, and it's just more than I've ever seen or experienced, and it's just, there's a silence of awe. And okay, I'm kind of a science fiction nerd too, but I've read about how astronauts who go into space, they experience Earth from orbit in a way that is described like awe and wonder, and even of being transformed by this perspective that puts them well outside of normal bounds. Psychologists have actually studied it and talk about it as the overview effect and other things, because it is such a perspective. It's an overwhelming sense of the universe and the place in which the Earth and people have within it. And it can be unsettling, I suppose. It's so enormous. So I don't know if astronauts talk about being afraid, but I'll bet there's that sense of being almost lost in it. It's so massive.
You know, that listening to y'all talk reminds me of that, and I'm going to summarize this because I'm going to get it wrong, paraphrase it. But, you know, when Job finally begins to crack and start to question God, God comes back and says, where were you when I, you know, hung the sun in its place and the stars and the moon and all this? Who are you to ask questions? And God doesn't answer his question. You know, Frederick Buechner says that in the end, even if God could explain it to him, he'd still be scratching and burning, you know, with his boils.
Right.
It wouldn't make any difference. But that sense of, you know, bigness. As Hurricane Florence was coming into the coast, I was remembering a lot of how I was feeling watching Katrina come and destroy the Gulf Coast where I grew up. Well, and I grew up in and around New Orleans, but that whole region. And then, of course, the levees broke in that whole disaster. And I remember how angry I was about, you know, preachers were saying this is God's judgment on Bourbon Street. And, of course, Bourbon Street was fine. You know, it was all these churches along the Gulf Coast that were wiped out. And the Baptist Seminary of New Orleans really took a hit. So, you know, I got mad at all that. And I got mad watching Pat Robertson pray. If we all pray enough that God will send this back, and it'll be kind of fun to watch it bounce around out there. And I got mad at that. But there was a bigger picture part of me that couldn't help but wonder if, you know, our human tendency to think that we can control nature and we could build wherever we want to build and conquer whatever we want to conquer. You know, we've been destroying the wetlands and all along the, and all these areas along the coast and the swamps, the Gulf Coast, and we've been building all these houses right there without fortification, knowing that they were, you know, going to be hit by hurricanes. And I get a Tower of Babel kind of feel that in the end, yeah, our human folly is nothing in the nature of God's natural rule. I don't know where I'm going with that. And I don't want to make light of any human suffering that's occurred, except that I remember thinking, well, maybe in a very totally different way, we are seeing God's wrath upon our human, our hubris.
And in it's in some society. Ways a natural consequence of our behavior.
Yes, right. Yes, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And certainly the warming of the seas and the atmosphere.
Exactly.
They are playing into these larger
storms. Global warming.
Yeah.
I mean, the hurricanes are getting stronger and stronger. So y'all decide if that should be.
Bert, as you were talking, you kind of sounded prophetic to me. You sounded like one of the prophets saying, it wasn't a sense of like pointing fingers, but it was this: as humanity collectively, we have made poor choices because our perspective is so limited, and we choose to let it be. And maybe it's that we have the audacity to think that our vision is the best vision, the way that we see things. Okay, so I have two things. So I had a seminary professor who used to say about children, he would say, children are excellent observers and terrible interpreters. And so this idea, we can see everything that there is around us, but if we do not have the right perspective, we cannot really understand what we're looking at. And I think about that. It's good parenting advice to remember that, but it is also a helpful perspective for us as we think about this passage. I had a unique experience myself of having my own perspective change when I grew up in a church in Atlanta, Georgia, and I have lots of memories of running around that church when I was I didn't grow up there, but I was there from age 3 to 6 or 7. So I have lots of memories running around that church, and all of my memories are of how big the church was, right? The hallways were really long, and the sanctuary was huge. And all my memories of that place were of how big it was. And then I had the great opportunity when I was in my 20s to go back to that same church. And I had not been there since we left when I was very, very young. And when I got there, I went, is this the same building? Like, I really thought it was a different building because it seemed so much smaller. I mean, and it was a very small church going back there. And so I think that there is this, you know, God's been around a lot longer, you know? And so there's this wisdom that we draw from, that we read in scripture. It's this, there's just a better viewpoint and learning that sometimes our perspective is inaccurate, or it is limited sometimes by how short our little legs are, as was the case in my church growing up. It took a lot longer to walk to the front of the sanctuary when I was 5 than it did when I was 25.
Yeah, Bert, I think another part of what I heard you saying was, you know, about our sense of control and even dominance of our lives and of this place. And we are reminded sometimes harshly that we aren't as much in control as we think we are. And in fact, this passage is pretty existential in a philosophical sense.
Yeah.
Right? In if we really stop and think about how little control we have over what is going on in our world or in our lives, it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. It really is. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I know what I'm planning to do tomorrow. I've got all my plans made. My clothes are set out, all that. And big deal, because guess what? Anything can happen tomorrow and change. And so, and I think we all know that, but we don't want to think about it. And the psalm and the existentialist wants to remind us that if we live honestly and authentically, we have some awareness of our lack of control and our lack of certainly of dominance. And that puts us in a more humble posture and maybe a more authentic posture. Well, maybe this psalm is a good reminder, and maybe it's one of the ways that as we practice contemplation, we take these moments in our days to pause and to reflect on our lives, both the joy in life, the hardness of life, but also the fact that we're not in control of much of it. There is so much unpredictable in our lives and in our world that maybe that makes us even more dependent on a God that is bigger than us, that loves us. And even though we can't see the long game, we have trust that God is to be there with us through it. Good song, hard song. Thank you guys for helping us look at it.
Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.